Good morning, Diane, and welcome to A Life in Biography.
Well, good morning, Carl.
I'm glad that you're here. For listeners who don't know it, Diane is the author of two biographies with great titles. I'm going to read the titles. Live Fast, Love Hard, The Farron Young Story. That's number one. Number two, 20th Century Drifter, The Life of Marty Robbins. And Diane is also, will keep you in a little bit of suspense, she's also working on another biography. But before we get to all that, oh, and also I should say she's also an autobiographer. And we might get into that a little bit if there's a connection here between autobiography and biography. But to begin with, Diane, just tell us a little bit about yourself, sort of where you come from, and how you got to doing biography.
I'm a South Dakota farm girl who joined the Navy when I graduated from college. And I started writing books, or I got interested in doing it in the early 1990s when I wanted to record our family stories. So I took a course in writing from the Institute of Children's Literature in Connecticut. And there I started writing my first memoir about growing up on a farm. And as I was doing it, I realized I'd rather write in my current voice. I didn't want to write children's books. I wanted to write it at a level that could be understood. So then the reason I got into biography is I'd been working on that for a while. And I was stationed in Japan when Farron Young died by suicide. And he was one of my favorite singers. And it seemed that he was being forgotten. And I didn't want him to be forgotten. And I thought, well, I need a retirement career when I retire from the Navy. So I thought, well, I'll write books. I'll write biographies. And I thought Farron would be a good one to start with.
That's it. I think that's one of the impulses for a lot of biographers is you've got a subject that maybe isn't necessarily famous or who has been forgotten, who was famous or popular, and it's time to sort of revisit that person. What interests me about the Farron Young biography is the way you begin it, because you talk a little bit about, well, who did you know? You weren't part of the music world, right? So what did you do?
Well, I started from scratch because I decided I wanted to write his biography. I knew nothing about how to write a biography. I didn't know anybody in the music business. I didn't know anybody in the publishing business. When I returned to the States from Japan, I was in Los Angeles in 1999. I bought a ticket one weekend and flew to Nashville just to see who I could find and get started on it. And the first person I met that weekend was Ralph Emery, who gave me support and incentive. And as I went on, I decided I would pick a publication date of 2007. I thought that was far enough in the future that people wouldn't always be asking me if the book is ready yet. and it would give me time to figure out how to write it. And also 2007 would be the Farron's 75th birthday. So I thought that was a good year. And I also knew that I wanted to have a book release party in Nashville with music by Farron's band, the Country Deputies. And I didn't know who any of those were at the time or how to get in touch with them. So I didn't know how I was going to get there. I just knew it was going to happen. And I eventually got a contract with the University of Illinois Press. And it was November of 2007. We had the book release party at the Ernest Tubb Record Shop. And Farron's band played on the Midnight Jamboree as a reunion of the Country Deputies. And so it all worked.
It sure did. My God, nobody tried to discourage you?
No, it was slow going at first, and one of my first supporters was Robin Young, Farron's son, because he told me the stories about the people who'd said they were going to write biographies and make movies, et cetera, and nothing ever happened. So he wanted to know that I was going to follow through. And at a party one night in Nashville, he introduced me as his daddy's biographer. And you know, that was a major boost for me to hear that. Since I didn't have any credibility at the time, I hadn't published my memoirs yet, so I had no published work. So I introduced myself to people as a Navy captain because I thought, well, that should show that I had some kind of credibility and stick-to-itiveness if I made it to being a Navy captain. So that was how I got started until I had my writing credibility.
Yeah, well, that reminds me a lot of my experiences when I was doing my first biography, and I didn't really know anybody, and it was of Marilyn Monroe, and I didn't really know anybody in Hollywood. I knew a few people in the acting profession, but they weren't, famous people or with particular connections. But you've got to start somewhere. And at that point, I was a college professor, and so I wasn't a Navy captain, but in a sense, I used that. And in other words, when I
Yes.
wrote to people, I wrote them on my university stationery, and since there had been, books about Marilyn Monroe by journalists primarily, a lot of people were intrigued that this college professor wanted to write about Marilyn Monroe. In fact, a lot of my colleagues looked askance at the idea of a professor of literature, of English, writing about Marilyn Monroe. So I think you use what you've got. And I think sometimes people don't write biography, or they think, oh, well, I've got to know so and so, or I've got to do such and such a thing. In your case, it's really so inspiring when you say essentially, I have the idea, I know it's worth doing, and somehow it's going to get done.
Right. I just started working on it and I didn't worry about what would happen. I didn't think, oh, should I do this? Should I give up? I just knew I was going to finish this book and it would get published. And I just kept moving to that goal.
So how did the contract with the University of Illinois Press, how did that come about?
I sent off queries, of course, to several publishers, agents, got turned down by all of them. I was advised that a university press might be good for this. And I, one of those was the University of Illinois Press. And then I realized I had, you know, and part of the advice is you go through all the biographies that you have and you look for agents and publishers and you contact them. And I had this book that was published by the Illinois Press in like 1975. It was a history of country music. And when I looked on the website, one of the editors of that, Judy McCullough, was still at the press. So I guess I emailed her and I had written a proposal by this time and sent that to her. And she was impressed that I had this book from 1975 and made that connection. So she was getting ready to retire. So she turned me over to Laurie Matheson. And by this time, like I said, I had the manuscript written so I could send them the complete manuscript, not just a proposal. And Laurie accepted it. And the Illinois Press has a series of American music, and they publish all kinds of books about singers. So, you know, it was a perfect fit to get there. And so that was in 2005. I signed that contract. And then, of course, we published in 2007.
That sounds great. I think that's a really sound way to do it. It's the kind of thing I've done. You look at who publishes figures like the one you want to write about, and editors who might be interested. It saves a lot of time because you're going to someone who's likely to be receptive. So it works for you. And you stayed with Illinois for the second book too, on Marty Robbins.
Well, I did. And in fact, Lori approached me about that one because as I was finishing up Ference, then I decided, well, Marty was also one of my favorite singers and there had been no biography written about him. And I asked myself the same two questions. Will I ever get tired of talking about him? Will I ever get tired of listening to his music? No. So I started working on that. And then when I think it was at a conference someplace or a book festival, Lori said, I understand you're working on the biography of Marty Robbins. We would like to publish it. And I said, sure. So it's simpler the second time around. Well, both for the publishing process and for finding people to interview, because some of them were the same people. And I now had credibility because I had a book to show off. And when it comes to my third one, Randy Travis, I figured his story could be a mainstream bestseller, but I balanced the effort of finding an agent and who find me a publisher and all the work involved in that, which would be almost as much work as writing the book itself, I think. So I just called up Lori and I said, I would like to do the biography of Randy Travis. And we discussed it. And of course she was happy to get that one. And we established a contract for that. The difference now is I had a contract at the beginning with a deadline, whereas my other two, I finished the books and then I got a contract. So now I'm writing with a contract and deadlines.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for staying with the same publisher if the terms seem good and you have good working relationships with the editors. I've done both the University Press published University Presses have published my biographies, and also trade book publishers. And although obviously there's a lot to be said for trade book publishing, especially in terms of the advances, usually University Presses can't compete with the advance against royalties that you get with a trade book. At the same time, they tend not to keep those books in print. I have yet to sign a contract with a trade book publisher where, in some cases, after the person who signed me up, the editor who signed me up, either moved or got fired, and the book became a kind of orphan. So when you establish these relationships, and of course, depending on what your motivations are as a biographer, if it isn't just money, and there's nothing wrong with making money, then it seems to me the decisions you made, I think you're right. I think it probably would have taken, even with Randy Travis, it probably would have taken a lot of heavy lifting to get an agent interested, and then the agent's got to get a publisher interested. That's a lot of work right there. It's a lot of psychological energy that goes into that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I wanted to focus on researching and writing the book. I didn't want to have to do all that, especially when I already had a publisher that would take it. So I wasn't trying to get rich off it. I wanted to get it published. And the point about staying in print, that's a major thing. All my Farron Young biography was published in 2007, Marty Robbins in 2012. You can go to the press and probably Amazon and still order both books because they keep their books in print.
Yeah, and that's true of a lot of university presses.
And that's major.
Yeah, no, it really is. Yeah, because otherwise, you know, you have to get the rights back, and then the reprint market for biographies, unless it's a very, you know, popular best-selling biography that sold thousands of copies, the chances of getting that book reprinted are slim, and then the biographer may be facing self-publishing, and that means not only paying something to get the book published, but of course all the promotion and so on is entirely on you when you go that route.
Right.
So, you know, you've got a publisher, you've got tremendous continuity. Maybe we should talk a little bit about what it's like now to do a biography of Randy Travis. I think I'm right, because we've talked about this a little bit before, that you didn't begin the book with some kind of in, some kind of connection to Randy Travis, did you?
No, I didn't. I'd been thinking about it for since like after I published my Marty Robbins book, and then I thought, well, I think I have one more biography in me, and this time I wanted to do it on a living singer, and one that I thought could be more of a seller, because of course Farron and Marty, they're niche books. I mean, they have their fans, but most people today have not heard of them. So the market is very small. So I wrote Randy letters over the years and sent him birthday cards and said, I'd like to write your biography. And I didn't hear anything. And what finally made me commit to do it was when he published his memoir in 2019, and I thought, well, now I have his story, because I couldn't talk to him, because after his stroke, he can no longer talk. He has aphasia. So I couldn't have interviewed him anyway. So someone had written his memoir, Ken Abraham, and he did a really good job of compiling all the people and putting it in Randy's voice and all that kind of stuff to tell his story. And I thought, well, that will be my base, where I have the outline of his life and a lot of people who I can track down to talk to. And so when I called Lori Matheson at the press, and we agreed, she agreed to give me a contract to go forward with it. Then as I had before, I started making phone calls and trying to find people to talk to. And I got the word that Mary Travis, Randy's wife, was against anybody writing a book about him. Well, I eventually contacted their publicist, Zach Farnham, and he set up a phone conference with Lori and me and Randy and Mary, and the five of us discussed the book, you know, and having my publisher in there talking about the credibility, et cetera, and what the press does. Then they realized this was a valid biography, and that kind of opened the door. I got more people to talk to. You know, they would call Randy and Mary and say, no, this person's trying to interview me. Should I talk to her? And they'd say yes. And then what worked out really well is they do these Randy Travis tribute shows a few a year, and one of them was scheduled for Mitchell, South Dakota. So we went there that afternoon to that concert, and that's the day I actually met Randy and Mary. And then I told them that I'd been wanting to come to Texas to visit all the medical professionals who had worked with Randy after his stroke. And of course, medical things, you can't do that without permission. And Mary agreed to set me up with some of those people. So we arranged for when I would come to Texas. And while we were there, Randy and Mary invited us over to visit and to spend the night at their house. And they showed me just, you know, they've got tons of Randy Travis stuff there that I if I wanted to, I could go down there and spend any amount of time going through all these things. So, you know, now I feel that I have a connection that I'll continue the way I have been going. But when I have questions or there's a specific piece of information that I'm looking for, I can call Mary and ask if she can get it for me.
That's terrific. You're doing well, Diane, that's for sure. Do you think it makes a difference that you're from South Dakota and not from, say, New York or Los Angeles, in terms of the trust that some people are placing in you?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I kind of think it might be. you know, you're very straightforward. You're down to earth. You've got this Navy background. You're not a, you don't come from a journalism background, for example. You're not an academic. It seems to me in a lot of ways, looking at it from people like Randy Travis's people, his family and so on, there's a lot there that I think they can place their trust in.
Well, I hope they can, because I feel that way about me. I am an honest and trustworthy person, and when I give my word, I keep it. And I want that impression of me to come across.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it does. I think it does in just even in the tone of your voice, the way you say things. I think it makes a difference. I think it's made a huge difference in my career when I've approached people and dealt with them directly and honestly. I think they really appreciate that, especially with subjects, as you said, you know, others have said they were going to write the biography and then they don't follow through. That was the case for me with one of my subjects, who you might also call a niche subject, Dana Andrews. Unless you really know Hollywood film, the name Dana Andrews probably doesn't mean anything to you, to a broad audience of general readers. But I found the niche audience was remarkable in its, you know, devotion to Dana Andrews and wanting to read about him. And the book has done as well, really, as my trade book biographies.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a surprise to me. I mean, one of my subjects most people have heard of, even if they haven't read her, Sylvia Plath. Well, my Dana Andrews biography has sold as many copies as my Sylvia Plath biography. And yet I ran into an agent at a Biographers International conference, a Hollywood agent, 1 year. And I said to him, I didn't even try to get a trade book publisher for the Dana Andrews. And I said to him, if I came to you and pitched, and this is after I had done several biographies, and pitched Dana Andrews, do you think you could sell it? He had a one-word answer: no. Mm-hmm. So I think your instincts were really spot on. I think what you've done is the right way to go. I wanted to say something about your newsletter.
Oh.
That I think biographers need to know about. And the reason they need to know about it is I read this newsletter, and I'm not a huge fan. I don't dislike country music. I don't listen to a lot of music of any kind, really. But I find your newsletters absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you.
And you're talking about musicians, some of whom I've never heard of, some of whom are names to me, some of whom who I have listened to or heard about. And what you're doing in your newsletter, you know, there are all kinds of newsletters where a writer, a biographer, say, you know, can send things out and say, this is what I'm doing and that sort of thing. And you certainly do that in your newsletter. But what you do in your newsletter, and I think this is why it is important for me to bring this up in the podcast, is you're really creating the world of country music in your newsletter. One of the things you do in the newsletter, for example, is you present excerpts from people who respond to the newsletter, and it becomes a kind of community of listeners and readers. Was all that deliberate?
Oh no, it all. Well, it actually started back in 2005 when I was doing my Farron Young research, and I had my family and friends, and I was getting in contact with some of the band members, the country deputies and other people as I was doing my interviews. And I thought, you know, it'd sure be nice to share some of this information. So I started that newsletter with like 40 addresses that I had or something. And I'd put things in like 50 years ago today, this is what Farron Young did. And then as people responded to me, I started printing their letters. So I did that for several years and then expanded. And then when I started working on Marty's newsletter, then I made it a Farron and Marty newsletter, and I focused on those too. Well, by the time and of course, kind of keep up on publication progress. And by the time I published Marty's biography in 2012 and moved into 13. And I thought, well, I might as well quit this newsletter because I've said it already.
Yeah.
And then my friend Perry Steele said, well, why don't you make it a general newsletter and write about other people? So I did. And then it kind of evolved. I'd come up with different things, and it came up with the spotlight where I could interview a particular person, or when I went on a trip someplace or a concert, I would just talk about all those things. And then I also started going through internet sites to find news blurbs about people. And then people started writing in about how much they liked it and all that. So it just grew. And sometimes it started with one page, and now sometimes it's 16 pages long because I have so much stuff to put in it. And then I've done a couple things. Like, it took about 2 years where I listed every member of the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I talk about a couple at a time. And at one point I had put in a little story about every one of the band members of Farron and Marty that I'd interviewed. I told their stories and different things like that. Now I'm writing about everybody who's been elected to the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. And there's like 240 of them. So you know, that's going to take several years. But I come up with these different themes and such. And I get all kinds of comments from people who say, that's the only way we keep up with what's going on in country music now is through your newsletter. So I have readers in Australia, Canada, England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Germany, the Netherlands, around the world.
It's extraordinary. I think we can put your newsletter in the Newsletter Hall of Fame. I tried when I was doing coming out with my Fokker biography, I tried a newsletter, and I wasn't any good at it. The podcast is doing what your newsletter is doing. My podcast reaches all mm-hmm. over the world too. It's I've had listeners in as many as 104 countries, which has just astounded me. The kind of range that this podcast is getting. And you're doing that with your newsletter. As you said, some of the issues are quite extensive. And I think one of the reasons for that is that everyone has a buy-in. That is, if they write to you and have something to say, they're likely to find themselves in the newsletter.
Yeah.
There's one Faulkner scholar, Taylor Haygood, who I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea of Taylor's, interest in country music because I'd only ever talked to him about Faulkner. So I'm reading your newsletter. Hey, there's Taylor.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about the community, and that's true because there are people who have connected through my newsletter. Some are old friends, and I get notes periodically saying, can you put me in touch with this person? I used to know him years ago, that sort of thing. So I've connected people like that, but they also read about each other, and then they'll write in comments about what somebody else said. And they'll let me know the latest. They'll say, I haven't heard from this person. Have you? Those kinds of things. But it is a real community.
Yeah. Anyone who looks at your newsletter can see that. Can see the sort of the depth and breadth of what you're doing. I wanted to ask you one technical question. Interviews?
Oh yes. I record everything. I record all my interviews and then I transcribe them exactly. I don't pick out the things that I might need. I transcribe their part, not my questions.
Yeah.
But I get their words exactly on paper. And then in the future, all I have to do is go to that Word file to find what this person said. I don't ever have to go back and try to find this spot on the recording where they might've said something. So yes, I, from the beginning with Farron, I used to record on cassette tapes and the little mini cassette tapes. And, you know, I had boxes of those. And now, of course, I have a digital recorder. So all my actual interviews I have on my computer, and then I transcribe them all. So no, it takes a lot of time and a lot of work.
Yeah.
It goes in the research category, because once you got it done, it's there available, and all you have to do is open the file and search for a word.
Yeah. I've done it differently. What I do is certainly not better than what you do. What you do is probably better than what I do. Especially when I began, I was doing biographies for both the Marilyn Monroe and Lillian Hellman biographies. I was still living in Detroit teaching at Wayne State University. And I was flying a lot to New York and to Los Angeles particularly, which is one reason I decided I got to move to one place or the other. It turned out to be New York. but I would record somebody in New York, let's say, the writer Diana Trilling and Lillian Hellman. And on the flight home, I wouldn't recording. What I would do is I would, and the tape recorder had a counter, I would say at 0016 or whatever, I would index the tape in the sense that I would indicate the topic that my subject, in this case, Diana Trilling, was talking about. And then I put these on index cards. And then as I was writing the book, I would look at these index cards and I'd go back and I'd listen to whatever particular part of the recording I was interested in for that part of the book. So I never did get around to actually making transcripts of my recordings. But I certainly understand the value of what you're doing as well. For me, it was because it was I had a full-time teaching job. At one point, I was even an administrator at Wayne State. And I was looking for any possible way to streamline, to make more efficient. And the other thing was, by constantly listening to the tapes and skipping around, it brought me into the actual conditions of the interview. That is the tone of voice, that kind of thing, which sometimes got into the biography as well. Whereas working with the transcript, you've got everything in front of you, words, but the oral part of it, listening to the tone of voice was extremely important. So there are lots of different ways to do this. There is no one right way. And of course, you've got to do what works best for you. I think that's the really important part of it.
I was just going to say, most of the interviews, all of mine, I guess, most of them have been via the telephone. So I'm home here anyway, so I don't have that flying time to be
right
on something. For me, it's worth it to put in the time up front to transcribe the thing. And I get what you say about the tone, but that's, and I don't know, maybe it's a difference in the type of biographies we write, but what I get from my interview subjects is mostly information. It's not how they feel about it. It's, you know, that you would get from their tone.
Sure.
The words.
Well, this is a digression, but my flying days are over.
Oh, are they?
I feel it is such a hassle. I will take a train. I won't take a bus, so it's got to be somewhere by train, or as in your case, the telephone. Because flying nowadays, I think I'd have to outfit myself with combat gear. it's just too much.
You know, it's nice to have met people and our trip to Texas, we went out for dinner one evening with some of Randy's and Mary's friends that I had found their names in Randy's memoir, and Mary she says, well, you need to talk to them. So it was really nice to meet them. And so what works best for me is to make the connection in person and then call them later and do a telephone interview, because you don't have all the distractions when you're on the phone.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Have you done any Zoom interviews where you've done video as well as the
No, I haven't. When I do an interview, I can't recall that I've ever done.
Yeah.
Because for one thing, the other person would have to set it up because I haven't ever figured out how to use it. I can participate in a Zoom call, but I've never messed with trying to set up.
It adds a technical level. And for me, it's true with this podcast. This podcast could turn video. I have the option, the technical option. They keep telling me, you can make your podcast video. I don't want it to be video. I want people to just listen.
No, I agree. And see, I'd rather write than talk. Well, email works good for me.
So one more thing, Diane. For a neophyte, someone who hasn't listened to a lot of Theron Young or Marty Robbins, what songs come to mind?
Well, Marty is still famous. I would say his two most famous ones are El Paso.
Yeah.
And he still gets a lot of credit down in El Paso for that song, which was put out 62 years ago. And the other one is Big Iron, because it showed up in, I forget what it is, but one of those games that people play electronically, apparently. Big Iron is a song played in that. So a lot of people know it from that. But his Gunfighter Ballads and Trail songs went into the Library of Congress in 2016. So those are the things he's probably most known for today, although he certainly had plenty of hit songs. And Theron, he seems to be best known for Hello Walls, which Willie Nelson wrote.
So usually
when you hear about Theron, it's because you're hearing about Willie Nelson's song, and one of them was Hello Walls. And then Sweet Dreams also, which is associated with Patsy Cline now, but Theron had the number two hit on it, and Patsy's only made it to like number six or something like that. So, and Going Steady was Theron's first big one. With YouTube nowadays, and that's the thing in my newsletter, I can write about a person or I can write about a song, and I don't have to do much explanation because everybody who's reading my email newsletter obviously has computer access. So you can look up almost any song in the world and find it on YouTube.
Yeah. That's a real advantage. Yeah. People talk a lot about all the, people don't write letters anymore. You know, how are biographers going to work? And I have to say that argument doesn't really impress me. There's so many ways now of recording a life, of the evidence of a life for biographers. Whatever was lost in the art of letter writing, and I'm not saying there wasn't something lost, there are so many gains that I can't spend my time lamenting that things aren't the way they used to be.
No, because when I think of my three subjects, I don't believe I've ever seen a letter written by Theron Young or Marty Robbins or Randy Travis, of course. But no, I never got anything from letters.
Yeah. I think that's the lament of literary biographies. For those of us who do more than just literary biography, that's not really much of an issue.
Well, back in the day when that's all they had was letters.
Yeah.
When you write about people from those eras, that's what there was.
Sure.
So, but like you said, we get lots of information and it doesn't come from letters.
Yep, that's right.
Times have changed.
For sure, yeah. So is there anything I should have asked you that you wanted to say?
Oh, well, we've just been having such a good discussion. Oh, we did talk about my other memoirs. I'll just mention them briefly.
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
I talked about the one that I started on growing up on a farm, which is a farm in the Hydewood. And I took that a course. Well, I took two courses from the Institute of Children's Literature. The second one was how to write a children's book. So as I got to the end of that correspondence course, and I was in Japan by this time, it said the last lesson in this course is to write the first chapter of your next book. And I thought, I don't have a second book. and immediately it occurred to me that I did. And I knew where it would begin and where it would end. It began when I went to school to be an aircraft maintenance officer in the Navy, and it would end 18 years later with my promotion to captain. So I started working on that book, and I wrote mostly the drafts of those in Japan. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I finished them up and I self-published both of those memoirs, A Farm in the Hideout and Navy Greenshirt, because they didn't have enough drama and conflict and all that to interest any kind of publisher. So I just published them myself just because I wanted them done. And then my...
They are available online. I noticed that Kindle Unlimited has your autobiographies there.
Well, my Navy Greenshirt one, I had an audio book made of that. And I used to have them all on Amazon and such, but that gets too expensive to carry it there when you don't sell very many. So I just have them on my website that people can get them through me. And then my third one, Mommy Watch Me, I published that, self-published that in 2020 during the pandemic, because while I was in Los Angeles, in addition to being a Navy captain in command of a defense contracting organization and self-publishing those two books and starting on Farron's biography, I also became a mother at age 50 when I adopted a pair of sisters, ages 5 and 7. So,
oh my. That's what
my third memoir, Mommy Watch Me, goes from 2000 when I got the girls until 2010 when, after I retired from the Navy and we moved from Maryland back to South Dakota. So that's my third one. So I got the three memoirs, and then I'm working on my third biography.
Well, Mommy Watch Me, I thinking of my daughter when she was quite young, Daddy Watch Me, it was exhausting.
I thought parents would get the title.
Well, they certainly do. And I have another title for you, Diane. Yeah. Here's another memoir you could write. From Butchering Chickens to Writing Biography.
Yeah, it's been a span of a lifetime.
Maybe we should stop there.
Okay. Well, we do need to let them know how to get my newsletter.
Yeah, you better tell us.
Okay. Well, they can send me an email, Diane@DianeDeekman.com. Do I need to spell that out or?
Yeah, spell it out. Okay.
DianeDeekman.com.
Great.
And that's also my website, DianeDeekman.com. So they can send me an email and I'll be happy to put them on my newsletter list.
Fantastic. Let's grow that list.
Okay.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Carl. I appreciate the call.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm going to post this. I'll send you a link so you can post it wherever you like.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.